Well, we're going to read again in James chapter 3, and again the passage we read, if you were here last week, we're looking at verses 13 really to 18, in particular verses 17 and 18 tonight, but I want to start the reading in chapter 3 and verse 7, because we're going to consider the tongue a little bit. James 3 and verse 7. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus no spring yields both salt water and fresh. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. As I said, just really those last two verses, but we're going to bring the tongue into it. The wisdom that is from above, says James here, and then adds, speaks of its qualities, that it's first pure, and then he speaks of, well, we can say seven other qualities. Two of them seem to be linked together with an and. But he begins with purity. Now, purity, of course, is a wide term. We can think of purity in terms of our whole lives. That's how we are to be. We are to be pure. We are to be untainted by sin. And this wisdom is said to be pure. Been looking in the past weeks with you at wisdom, and sometimes have made the distinction, haven't we, as we've been thinking how we should live, that sometimes the Bible clearly says this is right, this is wrong. We don't need any further guidance. But sometimes, in contrast, we need wisdom from God in decisions that we might have to make, where it's not clear that there is a right way and a wrong way morally, but there must be a better way and a worse way in terms of is this a good idea or not, and God tells us to ask for wisdom. And I've been emphasising that sort of distinction, knowing that I would get back tonight to be able to say, but actually, do not go away thinking that therefore wisdom is not a sort of moral quality. There is a wisdom, and a world's wisdom, and I don't mean that in a wrong sense, in a negative sense. There is a wisdom which is sort of common sense, isn't it, which is almost, you can say, without a moral quality. It's just knowing what is a good idea in a particular situation. But scriptural wisdom, when you get down to it, always has this moral quality to it. And this is the wisdom that comes from above. So, of course, we expect it to be pure because it comes from the God who is pure. But it's, you see, we're told that this wisdom too will lead us to the clean life. It will be the wisdom that produces in us a life where we are not, because we're wise, we see the traps. We see the temptations. We see Satan's devices. We don't fall into them. And this pure wisdom will produce purity in our life. Now, we're going to see how that works out in different areas. But first, I want to come back to this whole idea of the tongue. Because if the wisdom that comes above is first pure, it must involve being able to tame the tongue, which is certainly set out here in these first 12 verses as being something which of itself is very impure, of the tongue, which is described as a fire and a world of iniquity, and it defiles the whole body, and it's set on fire by hell, and it's an unruly evil full of deadly poison. Now, I expect we've all been struck by this, haven't we? James seems to be writing to Christians, and he describes our tongues like this. He's saying, if you don't do anything about it, that's what your tongue is going to be like. And he goes on in verses 11 and 12, can literally, this is a sort of more literal translation, though it's not much different, can the fountain out of the same opening send forth sweet and bitter? My brothers, can a fig tree bear olives or a vine figs? Neither can salt water produce sweet. If someone had, there's all sorts of wonders in the world, aren't they? But if someone said, oh, here is a fountain, and look, you can drink out of this side and you get salt water, and this side you get sweet. Well, you could, if it was in your field, you could make it a tourist attraction, couldn't you? And charge people to come and drink out of it. If you could make your fig trees, not that we can really do much of this in this country, but your fig trees bear olives, or perhaps we say our apple trees bear pears, and the other way round. People would come, the BBC would turn up, wouldn't they, and film them, if you let them know. That's sort of, it's curiosity, isn't it? It would be unusual, really unusual. In fact, we could say perhaps it would be an amazing wonder, and it should be considered an amazing wonder if someone can both bless God and curse man sincerely. It would be the sort of person you think, well, we've really got to go and see this person. Not someone who can happily curse man and just turn up in church and sing the hymns, because that's not what's meant, is it? It's meant that really, really, someone really blesses God and curses man. Well, that's pretty difficult. James is saying, you can't do it, can you? And that means that you see that what comes out of the mouth, is it sweet or sour, shows what the heart is really like. And isn't that what Jesus taught? In Matthew 12 and verse 34, he teaches words which I'm sure James, what James says is based on this. He says, or verse 33, rather make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree bad and its fruit bad. For a tree is known by its fruit. He's talking to the Pharisees. Brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good things, and an evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth evil things. But I say to you that every idle word men may speak, they will give account of it on the day of judgment, for by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. Jesus is saying it's a pretty good indication, isn't it, of what your heart is really like, is what you say. Oh, everybody can try and cover it up sometimes, but when you think it doesn't matter, and when you say what you really think. And so, why I want to bring this in is simply to say this, isn't it, that we must not think, you must not think that you are pure if your tongue is not pure. Now, we all sin, we all fail, we know that. But basically, is your tongue a tongue that is living for God? And I want to bear the tongue in mind through some of these other things that we're told about this wisdom as we look at verse 17. We will get to verse 18 at the end. Because the wisdom that comes from above is pure. You see, we're learning, aren't we? What is this wisdom? If we are meant to ask for wisdom, we ask God for wisdom, what's it going to look like when he answers? Well, it's first pure. It's pure in its motives. And it's going to be pure in its motives within a church. That's not the only level. But we can tend to always look at these things, can't we, individualistically. A pure life. A life lived, in moral purity, sexual purity, financial purity, whatever it might be. But we forget sometimes that there is this very important dimension. And that true wisdom is going to show in purity towards one another. Now, one of the areas where it's seen most, again, in its lacking is this, isn't it? You have somebody in a church and they have a hidden agenda. They don't put forward what they think because they think that they won't be in a majority, but they're always working, scheming, to try and get their own way. Not standing up openly, but secretly, one person at a time, trying to persuade people onto their side. Now, I'm not talking about anybody here because I don't know you. And if it's secret, it's secret, isn't it? And nobody else might know. But what I'm saying is that the wisdom that comes from above does not allow that sort of behaviour. That is not godly behaviour. Craftiness. Jesus said that we are to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. It's no good just taking the first part and saying I've got 50%, because that doesn't count. And I'm just saying this in order because Satan tempts, and if you think your church is at peace, then you've always got to be especially on your guard. And not trying to get things changed by craftiness, because that is not pure wisdom. And because this wisdom is pure, it is, you see, peaceable. It leads to actively promoting peace in the church. Mark 9 and verse 50. This we read, isn't it, is what God did. Here we are, Mark 9 and verse 50. Salt is good, but if the salt loses its flavour, how will you season it? Have salt in yourselves and have peace with one another. God brought peace. He promotes peace. He is a peaceable God. Romans 5. Teaches this, doesn't it, how we have reconciliation with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Or in Ephesians 4, we're told, aren't we, when Paul has given this magnificent statement in three chapters of the grace of God, he says, well, how do we respond to it? Ephesians 4, verse 1, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthily of the calling with which you were called, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long suffering, bearing with one another in love, endeavouring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Quite a few of those terms are similar, aren't they, to the one James is using here. And if you go back into Ephesians 2, isn't it striking the way that our salvation is described? He himself, verse 14, Christ, is our peace, who has made, now we're going to think he's going to talk about our peace with God, but he gets to that, but not yet. Who has made both one and has broken down the middle wall of separation, that is between Jew and Gentile, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create in himself one new man from the two, the Christian, thus making peace, and it that he might reconcile them both to God in one body through the cross, thereby putting to death the enmity. You see how this is describing that God is saying the way I bring peace is I've got people who are from the Jews, I've got people from the Gentiles, and in Christ I'm making them one. I'm bringing peace. And I'm bringing them to peace with myself. But the order is striking, isn't it? The emphasis there is actually on the peace that we have with one another before the peace that we have with God through the cross. We cannot say, I'm sure we can say, and I would say in many circumstances, what did Jesus achieve on the cross? So he achieved peace with, from God, reconciliation with sinners, of course. But in Ephesians, what is put first is the peace between, in that instance, Jew and Gentile. And that is obviously a picture of all broken down relationships where there was just hatred between the two, mutual suspicion and mutual abuse. The cross brings us together. So the wisdom from above is peaceable. Fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, so many times, isn't it? How important it is then to keep that peace. You remember, I won't go into it in depth now, but in Matthew 5, you're told, aren't you, what to do if your brother has something against you, and you even leave your gift at the altar, says Jesus, and go and get your brother reconciled. How important. Before even you worship God, it's more important, get your brother reconciled. In Matthew 18, it's the opposite way round. Here, you have something against your brother because he's sinned against you. And there is this great process to be put in place which hopefully at every stage reconciles the brother. But if not, in the end, sadly, he's put out of the church. Not for what he did to start with, but just because he's not listening to the church. So that's how seriously God takes peace, you see, in that other way, isn't it? If the brother will not be at peace with his brothers, then you have to put him outside for the peace of the church. It's not the aim of church discipline. It's what happens when, in a sense, it fails. In the sense that it's meant to restore the brother. It might fail because the brother is just contumacious and you couldn't have done any better. But it's a breakdown, isn't it? A visible breakdown of relationships. But it's, you see, taking those two passages together, how important it is that Jesus says that we have peace. And that if something seems to fracture that peace in our relationships, we put it right. And in this, of course, we have to remember the tongue, don't we? A peaceable tongue. Ephesians 4, again in Ephesians, isn't it? In verse 15, speaking the truth in love, we may grow up in all things into him who is the head, Christ. Part of striving to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace, earlier in the chapter, speaking the truth in love. Peaceable. Blessed are the peacemakers. They shall be called sons of God. And then this wisdom that is from above is gentle. Or the word perhaps means, you could say, forbearing. It's that kind of idea. It's one of the qualities that Paul says in 1 Timothy that an elder must have. It means reasonable in that sense. That is open to reason. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 18. And we have Peter there, speaks of this, and he says, servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, that's the word, the reasonable master, but to the unreasonable master, the harsh master. And I think James has spoken about this already, hasn't he, in this little book of his. Chapter 1, verses 19 to 21. My beloved brothers, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God, so lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness, and receive with meekness, the same word, the implanted word which is able to save your souls. The wisdom that comes from above makes us meek, gentle, forbearing. So if someone does something to you, it's obvious they didn't mean to do it or say it. It seemed unkind, but this is not a case though for church discipline, is it? It is a case sometimes just for putting up with it, because we've probably done the same thing last week to somebody else. We are to be gentle. Christianity should be marked by gentleness. Then we are not gentleness against sin, but gentleness with brothers and sisters who are not seeking in any way to be other than treating us right. Then it is compliance, really, the word means. It says here it is willing to yield, willing to be persuaded, willing to give way for the sake of peace, if it isn't sinful to do so. There are many occasions where we have to stand up, don't we? And here I stand, I can do no other. But compliance, again, being willing to be persuaded, that's what it means, really. Being willing to say, well, perhaps the other person is right. Well, they might not be right. But at least give some consideration to the fact that if you have wisdom, yes, but that doesn't mean you're always the one that's right. They might have wisdom too. And in this area, they might be wiser than you. So be forbearing, be gentle, be reasonable, be compliant as well. Here we are, I think James has covered this to some extent. In chapter 1, again, notice that we're coming through this in order. Perhaps I'm reading too much into this, but I think the illustrations of these words follow the order of what James has already taught us. He says, if anyone is a hearer of the word, not a doer, well, we're not to be like that. And he says we're to look into the word, and we're meant to see what's in the word, and we're meant to conform our life to the word and not just look at it and go away. We're meant to be those who are compliant to the word, aren't we? Well, it might be that the teaching that follows rightly from the word comes from somebody else. I think we should do this. And they might not always have a scripture, as it were, but I think we should do this. You've got to listen, because maybe the principles of the word are what they're saying, living by and speaking from. And then this wisdom that God gives from above is full of mercy and good fruit. Well, certainly that's the next part of what James said, wasn't it, in chapter 1? Because he said in verse 26, if anyone among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless. Pure and undefiled religion from God and Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. There it is, visiting orphans, widows in their culture even more than in ours. The people who had nothing. The breadwinner had died and they've not got any food tomorrow. And the church, we can see the emphasis in the New Testament, aren't we, on looking after them. Well, it might not be widows and orphans now. Perhaps there aren't many orphans, and perhaps your widows are the rich people in the church, but that's not always necessarily the case, is it? But you know what I mean? The point is you've got to identify the poor and the needy and help them. That, you see, is wisdom. You can't say, I'm a wise person, and you're not looking at everybody else, and you're not helping others in the church. How is that God's wisdom? And then it is to be without partiality. Well, James has certainly spoken about that in chapter 2 and those first 13 verses there, and about how, you know, the rich man comes in and you say, oh, sit here, please. Let's sit in the house. And there's a poor man, you stand at the back. Or you sit at the floor by my feet. Yeah, well, we have to make sure, don't we? We're not going to be as crass as that, but we have to make sure. Really, each one of us, we have to make sure that we do not treat people better because they seem to be someone who is more important, or someone perhaps who's more gifted, someone who's perhaps more prominent in the church. And, you know, the bigger the church, the more likely this is, isn't it? The person who just comes in, perhaps the godliest person in the church, comes in, sits there quietly, worships with everybody else, prays, and comes to the prayer meeting. But it's so quiet that no one notices they're there. And no one notices when they're not there. And no one notices when they've gone. And the church has ignored them. And it's not to be like that, is it? We are to treat each one equally. And equality can sometimes mean, can't it, that you say, here is the person who seems to be the only one who's on their own, so I'll go and be the person who talks to them. So that they're not the only one on their own. There's much more to say about partiality. And again, remember the tongue, isn't it? How easy it is just to talk to the people who you think you're going to have a pleasant conversation with, and not make the effort to speak to someone perhaps who it's not so easy for you to speak to. And then, lastly in this verse, without hypocrisy, unfeigned. Well, there's James in chapter 2, isn't it? Again, from verse 14 to 26. There is the hypocrisy of the person who thinks that because they have faith, meaning intellectual belief in certain truths, that they are all right. Oh, I don't have to do any works then. The wisdom that comes from above is a wisdom that is unhypocritical. It's a wisdom that's... Remember, Paul speaks of this, 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 12, and he says, for our boasting is this, the testimony of our conscience, that we conducted ourselves in the world in simplicity and godly sincerity, not with fleshly wisdom, but by the grace of God, and more abundantly toward you. Can your conscience say this? That you conduct yourself amongst your fellow believers here, in simplicity and godly, that's the opposite of hypocrisy, and godly sincerity, not with fleshly wisdom, but by the grace of God. You see, it's the wisdom God gives. And again, remember the tongue. Remember not to be saying something nice things to the person's front and something else behind their back. That's so easy, isn't it? Don't say behind their back what you can't say to their face. There could be times when that has to be an exception, but it's got to be, you've really got to think about that. If you think you're wise, well, maybe you don't, but you, I hope by now you'd be at least be seeing, I'm not sure, I'm not the only person who's taught on this, you should be seeing that you ought to be wise. So if you are wise, Are you like this? If you think you're wise, are you like this? And is this the wisdom you really seek? When you seek wisdom from God, is it not just, Lord, help me to make right decisions, but is it, Lord, make me pure and peaceable and gentle and willing to yield and full of mercy and good fruits without partiality and without hypocrisy? Are you expecting the answer to your prayer for wisdom to involve God changing you in these ways? Is that what you want? You see, I would suggest that every one of us would look at that list and you could think of every and say, wouldn't it be nice to live in a church where everybody was like this? Yeah, but I'm not going to bother. No, you can't do it, can you? You cannot expect to live amongst people who you expect, God, why aren't these people more peaceable? Why aren't they more willing to listen? Why do that person seem to be a bit hypocritical? Why does that person seem to be partially in some ways? Why don't you do something about it, Lord? Well, what about you then? Do you want him to do something about you? You see, I would suggest, as with all these lists we ever have of qualities, positive or negative in the New Testament, that there's going to be one or maybe more than one for each one of us here that we're going to have to say, this is where it really is something that's pricking my conscience. And it's going to be different things for different people. And again, it's very easy to spot what the other person, oh yes, so and so, they've got to do better at this. But it isn't do better at this, is it? It's pray for God's grace and God's wisdom for others as well as for yourself. When the Lord gave us a prayer, a model prayer, which covers everything really, and pray, let your name be hallowed, yet your kingdom come, let your will be done. He said, this is what the disciples, he says, you go into your own room and you pray it, but you're praying it not just for yourself, are you? You're praying that God will do this everywhere, but he's got to do it in you as well as for everybody else. More of God's reign in our soul. Ours individually as well as everybody else's. And then this verse 18, which sums it all up in this sense. Now the fruit of righteousness, we read it here in the New King James, is sown in peace by those who make peace. It's an awkward construction. Let me put this as a slightly alternative translation. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace for the peacemakers, not by those who make peace, but for the peacemakers. In other words, if we are peacemakers, God sows peace for us. And I think that's the right translation, not only because I think that's literal, but because in Isaiah 32, verse 17, which I'm sure James was alluding to, it says, the work of righteousness will be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. So it's talking about an internal peace. It's saying the fruit of righteousness is sown in an internal peace for those who are peacemakers. If we are peacemakers, God righteously sows peace for us. God righteously, if your heart is troubled and not at peace, do you need to be more of a peacemaker? Promote external peace, peace amongst others, to have internal peace. And again, you can see it from the opposite, can't you? How is the person who is always trying to stir up trouble going to have any real peace in their souls? They're always going to be, who am I at war with now? But if you are genuinely seeking to be at peace with one another and to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace, then your conscience can be at peace, can't it? And you can know the assurance, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. And God will promote righteousness in you also. Now, I'm going to speak as a friend of the church just for 1 minute. Don't worry, it's not a rebuke. It came up from last week, just to conclude. You've got big decisions, aren't you? All churches have big decisions. But you've got big decisions coming up, and it was out in the open. It's mentioned in the prayer meeting, and I checked with people afterwards and talking about Billy and how in a few years he'll be thinking of retirement. and what happens next, and you want wisdom, don't you? Wisdom from above to get it right. Of course we do. We want that for you too. So just to say, you see, deal with these decisions in wisdom and ask God for it. And he will answer your prayer, this is what that wisdom is going to look like. If God gives you wisdom, it's going to be pure and peaceable and gentle and willing to yield and full of mercy and good fruits without partiality and without hypocrisy. And as you deal with one another in that way, then you can expect God to bless your deliberations as to what should happen next and to give you wisdom so that his work is furthered here.